a great weekend.
This is VOA News, reporting by remote. I'm Michael Brown. The January 6th congressional panel has subpoenaed for former President Donald Trump's testimony on the Capitol attack. AP Washington correspondent Sagar Magani reports.
Vice Chair Liz Cheney's committee has voted unanimously to subpoena Donald Trump.
We are obligated to seek answers directly from the man who set this all in motion.
Trump is almost certain to refuse. Shortly after the panel's hearing ended, he asked on social media why the committee did not ask him to testify months ago. Instead, the vote came at the end of a hearing that sought to delve into his post-election mindset.
Donald Trump knew he lost,
but wanted to overturn his loss.
President Trump had a premeditated plan, purposeful lies.
It was intentional.
His intent was plain: ignore the rule of law and stay in power.
In a staggering betrayal of his oath,
none of this is normal or acceptable or lawful in our republic.
Sagar Magani, Washington.
The Supreme Court has rejected former President Trump's plea to step into the legal fight over seizure of classified documents during the FBI search of his Florida home. The High Court refused to consider former President Trump's emergency appeal without commenting. The Trump team was asking the justices to overturn a lower court ruling and permit an independent arbiter or special master to review the roughly 100 documents with classified markings that were seized. A three-judge appellate court panel had sided with the Justice Department. It argued there was no legal basis for the special master to conduct his own review of the classified records. For more news, please join us at our website, voanews.com, or the VOA mobile app. Via remote, this is VOA News. South Korea says North Korea has launched a ballistic missile toward its eastern waters. South Korea's Joint Chiefs of Staff says the launch happened early Friday, but gave no further details. It's the latest in a spate of missile launches by North Korea in recent days. South Korea's Joint Chiefs of Staff says North Korea also flew warplanes near the rival's border late Thursday and early Friday, prompting South Korea to scramble fighter jets. There have been no reports of clashes between the two Koreas. A jury in the U.S. spared Florida school shooter Nicholas Cruz from the death penalty on Thursday. AP correspondent Ed Donahue reports.
The jury could not reach a unanimous decision to sentence Cruz to death. Instead, it's life without parole.
This should have been the death penalty, 100%.
Lori Aladeff's daughter was one of the 17 killed at Marjorie Stoneman Douglas High School.
I sent my daughter to school, and she was shot 8 times.
Cruz, his hair unkempt, largely sat hunched over and stared at the table as the jury's recommendations were read. His lawyers claim Cruz had a difficult upbringing. Linda Beagle Schulman's son was killed. She says prison life won't be easy for Cruz.
I hope he has the fear in him every second of his life, just the way he gave that fear to every one of our loved ones who he murdered.
Florida Governor Ron DeSantis agreed with the families, saying it stings that Cruz will not receive the death penalty. I'm Ed Donahue.
Iraqi lawmakers elected a new president in a key step toward ending a year-long political vacuum. Parliament voted for Abdul Rashid, a former minister, as president on Thursday. The session was threatened after 9 rockets fell near the parliament building. Iraqi security officials say at least 5 people were wounded in the attack, including 3 civilians. There was no immediate claim of responsibility for the attack. A bus bombing in suburban Damascus killed 18 Syrian soldiers. Syrian state media, citing a military source, reported the blast on Thursday also wounded 27 others. Similar attacks in the past years have killed and wounded dozens of soldiers in government-held parts of the war-torn country. Saudi Arabia rejected an not-as-based-on-fact criticism of an OPEC decision last week to cut its oil production target despite U.S. objections, and said on Thursday that Washington's request to delay the cut by a month would have had negative economic consequences. For more news, as always, we invite you to join us at our website, voanews.com, or the VOA mobile app. Reporting by remote, I'm Michael Brown, VOA News.
Today is Friday, October 14th, and this is VOA's International Edition. I am Chinedofo in Washington. Coming up in the next half hour, NATO unveils plans to beef up Europe's air defenses as top U.S. general pledges more aid to Ukraine.
NATO stands more unified and more resolute than ever. Today, this proud alliance of free countries stands together to condemn Russia's illegal and unprovoked invasion of Ukraine.
A new report finds half of all countries globally lack early warning systems that could save lives.
Extreme weather is increasing in frequency and intensity. The United Nations estimates up to 3.6 billion people live in areas that are highly vulnerable to climate change and related disasters.
And the U.S. House January 6th committee subpoenas former President Donald Trump about the 2021 Capitol attack. We'll have these stories and more next on International Edition. Stay tuned. NATO allies meeting in Brussels on Thursday unveiled plans to beef up Europe's air defenses with Patriot and other missile systems. This as U.S. Secretary of Defense Lloyd Austin said Washington will immediately supply Kyiv with four additional high-mobility artillery rocket system or HIMARS launchers ahead of a further delivery of 18 launchers. Moscow said military aid for Kyiv made members of the U.S.-led alliance, quote, a direct party to the conflict, unquote, and said admitting Ukraine to NATO would trigger a global conflict. But Austin said Russia had made a choice to attack Ukraine and could resolve the conflict by withdrawing.
NATO stands more unified and more resolute than ever. Today, this proud alliance of free countries stands together to condemn Russia's illegal and unprovoked invasion of Ukraine. You know, Putin thought he could easily conquer his peaceful neighbor. Yet the Kremlin's war of choice is now in its eighth month. Putin's mobilization effort, his bellicose rhetoric, his cruel attacks on civilian targets, and his hollow attempt to annex Ukrainian territory all show how Ukraine's courage and skill have disrupted Russia's hope for a quick war of conquest. NATO continues to make clear that we will not be dragged into Russia's war of choice, but we will stand by Ukraine as it fights to defend itself, and we will continue to strengthen NATO's collective defense. I would also say that one change that could be made today is that Russia could choose to de-escalate and could choose to end this war because Putin started this war as a matter of choice.
That's U.S. Secretary of Defense Lloyd Austin. Turkish President Recep Tayyip Erdogan met his Russian counterpart Vladimir Putin Thursday for the fourth time in many months. As Dorian Jones reports from Istanbul, the frequent meetings include ties are fueling concerns among Western allies that Ankara is circumventing sanctions against Russia.
Turkish President Recep Tayyip Erdogan and Russian President Vladimir Putin smiled as they met for the fourth time since July. The latest encounter was in Astana on the sidelines of the summit of the Conference on Interaction and Confidence-Building Measures in Asia. Speaking to reporters after his meeting, Erdogan says he wants to build on the success of the United Nations brokered deal that allows Ukrainian grain blockaded by Russian naval forces to enter world markets. Erdogan says Turkey is determined to strengthen and continue the grain exports under the Istanbul Agreement and the transfer of Russian grain and fertilizer to less developed countries via Turkey. Ankara played a pivotal role in assisting the United Nations in brokering the grain deal between Ukraine and Russia, known as the Istanbul Agreement. Putin Thursday criticized the deal's implementation, claiming countries in need are not benefiting from the agreement. The deal comes up for renewal next month. Gulab Dalai of London's Chatham House says the Ukrainian grain deal is seen as a vindication by Erdogan of his policy of maintaining close ties with Putin.
The role that Turkey can play is very much contingent upon having a working relationship with Russia. The grain deal is one of them. Turkey highly likely can play a more humanitarian role down the road. More diplomatic role, and all of them will require Turkey having some sort of a functional relationship with Moscow as well.
Stressing the need to maintain close ties with Moscow, Ankara refuses to enforce Western sanctions against Russia. The European Union, in a report this week, strongly criticised Ankara for not enforcing sanctions and warned that European companies could use Turkey to circumvent the restrictions. Washington has also voiced concern. Such complaints are likely to grow, with Putin Thursday repeating a suggestion to use Turkey as a hub for distributing Russian gas that was originally intended for Europe. Erdogan has not commented on the proposal. Senior strategist Timothy Ash of Blue Bay Asset Management says Putin is seeking to create divisions among his Western adversaries and is finding a willing partner in Erdogan.
For Putin, you know, the relationship with Turkey is important, really, just because it's about dividing Europe. Obviously, Turkey is a key NATO member, and the more he can kind of pull Erdogan and Turkey away from the West, that's all the better. And for Turkey, I mean, Erdogan, you know, he's got elections due by June next year. He's got a very difficult balance of payments issue. And he thinks by helping Russia get around sanctions that Turkey can earn key balance of payments receipts from that, and that will help.
Ankara denies its sanction busting. But observers say Erdogan is walking an increasingly fine line by looking to keep close ties with Russia, knowing at the same time that his dealings with Moscow could trigger retaliation from the US and Europe in the form of secondary sanctions. Dorian Jones for VOA News, Istanbul.
Thank you, Dorian. South Korea says North Korea has launched a ballistic missile towards its eastern waters. South Korea's Joint Chief of Staff says the launch happened early Friday, but gave no further details. It's the latest in a spread of missile launches by North Korea in recent days. South Korea's Joint Chiefs of Staff said North Korea also flew warplanes near the rival borders late Thursday and early Friday, prompting South Korea to scramble fighter jets. There have been no reports of clashes between the two Koreas. Associated Press correspondent Lisa Dyer reports.
North Korea says leader Kim Jong-un has supervised tests of long-range cruise missiles, which he described as a successful demonstration of his military's expanding nuclear strike capabilities and readiness for actual war. South Korean officials say Kim may also conduct a nuclear test in the coming weeks or months, escalating a pressure campaign aimed at forcing the United States to accept the idea of the North as a nuclear power and to be able to negotiate concessions from a position of strength. Analysts say Kim is exploiting the distraction created by Russia's war on Ukraine, using it as a window to accelerate arms development as he pursues a full-fledged nuclear arsenal that could viably threaten regional U.S. allies and the United States. I'm Lisa Dwyer.
Anti-government protests are continuing across Iran following the death of 22-year-old Mahsa Amini in police custody last month. She had been arrested by Iran's morality police for, quote, unsuitable attire, unquote. Where might the protests lead and how should the West respond? Henry Ridgewell reports from London.
At Tehran University, students gathered to spell out the word blood in Farsi, demanding the fall of the Islamic regime. For 4 weeks, protests, many led by women, have gripped cities across Iran. Ali Vaez is an Iran analyst at the International Crisis Group.
It's really impressive that for them, the wall of fear has been completely destroyed and they have increasingly nothing to lose and therefore they are willing to persist.
Past protests such as the 2009 Green Movement failed to bring down the government. But resentment now transcends political divides amid economic crisis and domestic repression, says analyst Benam Ben Taleblu.
Rather than being advocating for one element of the regime, this is the population saying they're done with the regime in its entirety.
Dozens of protesters have been killed. The regime still has scope to crush the demonstrations, says Vaez.
It has not yet deployed the Revolutionary Guards, and so it still has a lot of repressive tools up its sleeve that it can use against the movement.
Britain last week followed the United States and Canada in imposing sanctions on senior figures in Iran's morality police, says analyst Benam Ben Taleblu of the Foundation for the Defense of Democracies in Washington.
That needs to be expanded across the European Union.
In Europe, female lawmakers and celebrities have cut their hair in solidarity with Iranian women. There have been protests in several cities. This protester in London did not want to give her name.
We are here to be the voice of the people in Iran, and we are here to demand for the British government to speak up.
The demonstrations come as the US and European powers negotiate with Tehran over a possible return to the 2015 nuclear deal. French President Emmanuel Macron Wednesday condemned Iran's crackdown, but said France was fighting to prevent nuclear proliferation. The nuclear talks have failed and should be abandoned, argues analyst Teleblu.
That money, that deal, would enrich the regime's security apparatus. And that security apparatus is the same apparatus engaging in foreign aggression and in the domestic repression we've been seeing now for about 4 weeks.
Teleblu said the West could take practical steps to help the protesters, including the provision of satellite internet to circumvent government restrictions. Henry Ridgewell for VOA News, London.
A new report finds half of all countries globally lack early warning systems that could save lives by alerting communities of impending disasters, including typhoons, droughts and heat waves. The joint report by the UN Office for Disaster Risk Reduction and the World Meteorological Organization is being released to mark the International Day for Disaster Risk Reduction. Lisa Schlein reports for VOA from Geneva.
Extreme weather is increasing in frequency and intensity. The United Nations estimates up to 3.6 billion people live in areas that are highly vulnerable to climate change and related disasters. It says the number of recorded disasters has increased by a factor of 5, driven in part by human-induced climate change and more extreme, unpredictable weather events. The UNDRR predicts 560 disasters will take place annually by the year 2030. It warns the number of droughts will increase by 30% and the number of scorching heat waves will triple by 2030. Loretta Heber-Girardi is UNDRR's chief of the Risk Knowledge Monitoring and Capacity Development Branch. She says the best ways for communities to protect themselves and to adapt to climate change is to scale up early warning systems. Yet, she notes, only half of the world has functioning systems in place.
This means that one out of three people globally, primarily in small island developing states and least developed countries, and six out of every 10 persons in Africa lack access to effective early warning systems. This is unacceptable.
She says lack of early warning leads to loss of lives and livelihoods and unnecessary damage to assets. She says new data show disaster-related deaths are 8 times higher in countries with limited early warning coverage than in those that have comprehensive systems in place.
And yet we know that early warnings by only 24 hours can cut the ensuing damage by 30%. A climate-related hazard does not have to translate into a disaster. It becomes a disaster because communities are not prepared and because the vulnerabilities and exposure of that community has not been mitigated.
Many early warning systems cover only one type of hazard, like floods or cyclones. However, given the many extreme, unpredictable climate change-related events, the United Nations urges countries to invest in multi-hazard early warning systems. Such systems, it notes, can address several climate-induced disasters that may occur simultaneously. Lisa Schlein for VOA News, Geneva.
In other news, the House January 6th committee has subpoenaed former President Donald Trump for his testimony about the 2021 Capitol attack. The panel voted unanimously to compel the former president to appear. The committee vice chair, Representative Liz Cheney, said, quote, "We must seek the testimony on the oath of January 6th central player," unquote. She added, quote, "We are obligated to seek answers directly from the man who set this all up in motion. And every American is entitled to those answers." Unquote. You're listening to VOA's International Edition. I am Chinua Dolfo in Washington. The acting head of the Africa Centers for Disease Control and Prevention says Africa must plan to respond effectively to disease outbreaks without outside help, warning Africa is, quote, on its own during pandemics, unquote. Ahmed Agwa was speaking to Africa public health officials gathered in Kampala, Uganda, Wednesday to plan cross-border cooperation for responding to the Ebola outbreak. Dr. Amasha Dalja is an infectious disease expert with the Johns Hopkins Center for Health Security in Baltimore, Maryland. He tells VOA's Carol Van Dam that when there's an emergency, countries where the outbreak is not occurring are often reticent to get involved.
There is a lag, that it's very reactive, and when the actions are taken, they're often domestically aimed. For example, travel screenings or travel bans, rather than actually dealing with the outbreak at its source. We've seen this time and time again, from Ebola in 2013, 2014, to monkeypox, to the current Ebola outbreak in Uganda. It's always going to be the case that many of the countries of the world are not going to be concerned until the outbreak impinges on their borders, even though that's short-sighted and doesn't reflect the nature of infectious disease. It's a tendency of political leaders to play to their domestic audience and to be very reactive instead of proactive. So that leaves continents like Africa needing to build up their own capacity to be able to be the first response, to be able to durably suppress an infectious disease outbreak there without external help.
There's an outbreak of Ebola in Uganda for which there is no vaccine. Is Uganda handling the outbreak, Anchon?
The outbreak of Ebola in Uganda is very concerning because it's with a strain of Ebola for which we have no countermeasures. The Ugandan government is trying to handle this with contact tracing, with personal protective equipment, and they are relying on some help from Doctors Without Borders and other NGO organizations. But I think that time will tell whether the actions that they're taking are going to be sufficient to suppress this outbreak. Uganda has dealt with Ebola outbreaks maybe a half dozen times before, so there is confidence that they can handle this outbreak. But we'll see, because there are cases now, at least one case reported in the capital city, and it becomes much more difficult when you're dealing with Ebola in urban environments than when you're dealing with it in rural environments. So I think it's going to take some time to know how well the actions that they're taking are going to impact this outbreak. But I suspect it will eventually be extinguished, because Ebola is not a very contagious disease. But the quicker that it gets extinguished, the safer everybody will be.
Africa's 54 countries have not received adequate international support in recent health crises, according to certain experts. Do you agree with that?
The case with infectious disease emergencies and global health crises is often that countries focus domestically on how the crisis will impact their domestic population, and other parts of the world are an afterthought. And the danger is that when you're talking about a communicable infectious disease outbreak, there's no guarantee that it stays in one place, and the longer you allow it to fester in one area, the greater risk that you have in other parts of the world, and the harder it's going to be to contain.
That's Dr. Amasha Dalja, an infectious diseases physician with the Johns Hopkins Bloomberg School for Public Health and a senior scholar with Johns Hopkins Center for Health Security. He spoke with my colleague, Carol Van Dam. A business in Nigeria is recycling discarded laptops into solar lanterns, creating a solution to the country's severe power outages, while also helping to tackle climate change. David Doyle of Reuters has more.
For employees at Nigeria's Quadloop, old laptops are much more than just electronic waste. They are a source of light. The company recycles the lithium batteries inside, as well as other parts such as wires, screws and screens, into solar lanterns. Quadloop founder Dozie Aguelo says there is a market for locally produced affordable electronics in Nigeria, but that many of the components are not available.
You notice that, yes, there's a market for this, and if we leverage electronic waste, we're going to cut down the cost of production as well as cost of sales. That's when we started building, and that's what brought us to where we are today.
Iguelo says many of the customers for the solar units, which sell for $32 each, are small businesses. In a country that suffers severe power outages, it's a way for them to stay productive. One such client is Blessing Samuel. The hairdresser says she previously had to run her generator at night or postpone unfinished work to the following day.
Believe me, I'll be stressed and find the extra expenses.
Iguelo says there is a pressing need for cheaper devices in Africa's most populous country. As well as small businesses, his target market includes local community hospitals. Amid Nigeria's energy crisis, it's a way for them to keep the lights on, with the added bonus of helping tackle climate change.
That's David Doyle of Reuters.
This is Science in a Minute.
NASA has announced a new launch date for its unmanned Artemis 1 mission to the moon and back. The space agency says the launch will be attempted during a 69-minute window that starts at 12:07 Eastern Standard Time on Monday, November 14th. NASA previously attempted to launch its powerful new SLS rocket with its Orion capsule atop on August 29th and September 3rd, but those attempts were scrubbed due to technical issues with the rocket. The space agency then scheduled a third attempt for September 27th, but that launch was canceled due to weather concerns related to Hurricane Ian. NASA then took protective measures and rolled the spacecraft back to the Vehicle Assembly Building on September 26th and plans to roll it back to the launch pad as early as Friday, November 4th. I'm VOA's Rick Pantaleo.
This has been International Edition on the Voice of America. On behalf of the entire production team, thank you so much for listening. Visit our website for in-depth coverage of world events and news 24 hours at voanews.com and check out voaafrica.com for more English language programming. You can find International Edition on our current affairs program, Encounter, Press Conference USA and Issues in the News on voanews.com. Until next time, I'm Chinadofo in Washington. Have a wonderful weekend.
Next, an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.
In response to the tragic and brutal death of a young Iranian woman, Mahsa Amini, as well as the violent suppression of peaceful protests, Secretary of State Antony Blinken has announced sanctions against Iran's so-called morality police and senior security officials. 22-year-old Mahsa Amini was arrested in Tehran for purportedly wearing a hijab too loosely. She died while in custody of Iran's so-called morality police. Street patrols by the morality police in Iran intensified this summer. President Ibrahim Raisi had called for strict enforcement of laws imposed after the revolution in 1979 that oblige women to cover their hair and wear long, loose-fitting clothes. Protests throughout Iran erupted after Amini's death. They have been met with force by the authorities. The Iranian government's crackdown is ongoing. Authorities have reportedly killed dozens of protesters, and last week the Iranian government cut off access to the internet for most of the 80 million citizens to prevent them and the rest of the world from watching its ongoing violent crackdown on peaceful protesters. In a separate statement, the Treasury Department said the officials designated by the Office of Foreign Assets Control oversee organizations that routinely employ violence to suppress peaceful protests and members of Iran's civil society, political dissidents, women's rights activists, and members of the Baha'i community. The seven designated officials include Iran's Minister of Intelligence and Security, the head of Iran's Morality Police, and the head of its Tehran division. The sanctions also target the deputy commander of the Basij, the deputy commander of Iran's Law Enforcement Forces, the LEF, the LEF commander of Chahar Mahal and Bakhtiari province, and the commander of the Iranian Army's ground forces. These men have been involved in serious rights abuses, including violence against detainees and the use of deadly force against protesters. Treasury Secretary Janet Yellen called the death of Mahsa Amini another act of brutality by the Iranian regime's security forces against its own people. She added, "We condemn this unconscionable act in the strongest terms and call on the Iranian government to end its violence against women and its ongoing violent crackdown on free expression and assembly." Today's actions, Secretary Yellen declared, demonstrates the Biden-Harris administration's clear commitment to stand up for human rights and the rights of women in Iran and globally.
That was an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.